Well, as we continue this amazing discussion with Roger Stone, we're going to take your phone calls with him this hour as well, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Roger Stone. So, Roger, the individual who saw Malcolm Wallace escaping, running out of the school book depository, he escapes a bombing of his car?
He escapes several attempts on his life in both Texas and Montana. And then finally, he gets a subpoena to appear for Jim Garrison in New Orleans. When in New Orleans, he's attacked on this street with two men with guns. But unfortunately for them, Richard Carr is packing, and he's faster on the draw. He kills one of the two men. The other guy runs. Now, what was it that this man saw that was so disturbing to somebody? Because there were numerous attempts on his life.
Well, I think we now know, don't we? Now, this was a great story, though, that had been really not reported at all. How did you uncover this?
Well, I mean, look, I stand on the shoulders of other truly great writers. Phil Nelson's done a two-volume biography on LBJ that is masterful. My friend Barb McClellan, who had a special vantage point from the law firm that represented Lyndon Johnson personally and who knew Ed Clark, the secret boss of Texas. I stand on both their scholarship, a very fine book entitled The Men on the Sixth Floor. Recently, an author named Joan Mellon, who has written some on the Kennedy assassination and the strange Dr. George de Morenshield, a close friend of George H.W. Bush, who we believe was Oswald's handler in Dallas for the agency. She has written an odd book in which she tries to absolve LBJ. She claims that the fingerprints that were found in the sniper's nest at the Texas School Book Depository building do not match those of Malcolm Wallace. I've now had them matched three times at a cost of several thousand dollars each time from forensic specialists. They are most definitely a match. So
he was there.
Yeah, Ms. Mellon's book, I don't know if Ben Barnes paid her to do this or she's getting a grant from the LBJ Library. I have no idea. But her book is just entirely wrong.
And most of these players now, Roger, I assume, are dead, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. George H.W. Bush is the last kind of survivor, as we know now. For 30 years, George Bush said he couldn't remember where he was on the day Kennedy was killed.
Everybody. I was 13 and remember where I was.
Well, and then in the 1980s, two documents are declassified by the federal government, both of which put him in Dallas. J. Edgar Hoover writes a memo to his underlings at the FBI instructing them to brief George Bush of the CIA on the activities of right-wing Cubans in the Dallas area. And then a second memo, even more disturbing, memorializes a phone conversation between George H.W. Bush and a fellow named Kitchell, who is the head of the FBI Bureau in Houston. Within minutes of Kennedy being shot, George Bush calls the Houston FBI agent to report that he has heard from somebody who heard from somebody who heard from somebody that there's a young man named James Parrott, a young Republican in Harris County, who may have made a threat against the president's life. But he says in the phone call that he's in Tyler, Texas, three times. So in my opinion, he is trying to establish an alibi as to his whereabouts.
Mm-hmm.
When the FBI, or in this case the Secret Service, tracked down Mr. Parrott, they find him in the garage of his parents' home, where he is painting George Bush for the U.S. Senate signs.
What's the Ruby connection with all of this?
Well, I mean, Ruby is, even though the Warren Commission told us Jack Ruby had no known ties to organized crime, that's a joke. He is a button man for Carlos Marcello. He has worked for Marcello in Chicago. He's worked for Marcello in Cuba.
He knew Oswald, right?
He knew Oswald. That has been established. He and Oswald are seen by several witnesses who then have immediate problems with their health, like they're killed. This is something, there's an extraordinary number of mysterious deaths and sudden deaths, a disproportionate number mathematically than possible of all of the witnesses who tie into small or large parts of the Kennedy assassination.
The columnist Dorothy Kilgallen, she died early.
A perfect example. So it is, as I established in my book on Nixon, Nixon knew Jack Ruby as early as 1947, when Murray Schottner, who was Nixon's kind of eminence grease, his Svengali, brought him Ruby and said that Lyndon Johnson, who was then in the House, noticed that Nixon had excess money in his budget, his staff budget, and asked that Ruby be picked up as an informant for the House Un-American Activities Committee. I have a document that proves this. Some have incorrectly tried to discredit the document because, although it was, we think the year is 1947, the address that appears at the top of the document has a zip code, means that it would have been much later. The problem is that what they're looking at is a buck slip that was clipped to the top of the document by the House Committee on Assassinations. The document, the underlying document, shows that Nixon indeed put Jack Rubenstein of Chicago, that's Jack Ruby, on the House payroll in 1947, and Nixon explained that this was a patronage favor for his fellow Congressman Lyndon Johnson.
This is amazing. Absolutely amazing. The connection would curl anybody. Yet the Warren Commission scoffed over all of this, didn't it?
Well, I mean, they have a fundamental problem. They pull in Arlen Specter, who I knew extremely well. And Specter is a very meticulous, very buttoned down, but very aggressive young man in a hurry. He's very ambitious. And essentially, the Chief Justice and the former head of the CIA call him in and tell him, here's what we've concluded. Three bullets, all from behind, all shot by this lone nut Oswald, who's some kind of commie.
Now you make it work. Yeah.
Now you go prove it. And Specter is on his way to proving it. And then there is a story in the Dallas Times Herald that he's wrapped up his investigation, that Kennedy is shot. There's only three shots, and he's shot from behind. At that point, a man named Jim Tague, who had been standing watching the motorcade go by, when a bullet hit the curb in front of him and a piece of cement bounced up and grazed his cheek and he bled. And standing next to him was a Dallas County deputy sheriff who witnessed all of this. There's a nick in the sidewalk where the bullet has hit. So Tague goes and reports this fourth bullet, in essence, to the Dallas police, and then he hears nothing. He expects they're going to come question him. Nothing happens. Then he reads in the paper that Specter is about to wrap this up with three bullets, and he knows there's a fourth bullet because it fell at his feet.
Yeah.
He goes into a bar. He meets Jim Lair, who's then an AP reporter. Lair writes the story about the fourth bullet. Arlen Specter's got a giant problem. This is why he invents the single bullet theory.
Mm-hmm.
He's got too many bullets.
Yep. The video of the Secret Service agent who was jogging alongside the presidential limousine, and then he's called off, and he throws his hands up in the air like, what are you people doing? Have you seen that?
I worked for three presidents, and I know the protocol. There is supposed to be an agent aside the rear axle anytime the president's car drops below 15 miles an hour. There's supposed to be two agents on the rear bumper. There's supposed to be six motorcycles. There were six motorcycles when the motorcade left the airport, but four of them were later called off. And then the motorcycle is supposed to ride concurrent with the car, the first set ahead, the other two on the sides, and then the third motorcycle duo behind. If you look at the pictures, the cops are always behind the presidential car, and they call off four of the bikers. Then all the buildings on both sides of the street are supposed to be searched and sealed. That hasn't happened. There's supposed to be agents in the crowd. That hasn't happened. So there's no reason why the Secret Service evades so many of their own rules. The right turns in the motorcade are prohibited. It is very clear. Now we think we understand why the director of the Secret Service, a fellow named Rowley, is the first man who bounds up the steps at Andrews Air Force Base to embrace new President Lyndon Baines Johnson. Turns out Mr. Rowley is a former deputy to J. Edgar Hoover and a man who got his first job in government from Congressman Lyndon Baines Johnson.
So Attorney General Robert Kennedy stays under Lyndon Johnson. He must have hated that.
Well, he stays very briefly. In essence, Johnson makes Nicholas Katzenbach, the acting attorney general. People have often asked me, as I've talked about my book, The Man Who Killed Kennedy, why Bobby didn't blow the whistle on this. And it's a very simple solution. Who would have believed him? Johnson controls the FBI. Johnson controls the Dallas police. Johnson has the ear of the media. The stories into his corruption are immediately spiked and never appear again. Robert Kennedy knew that the only way he could uncover the true murder of his brother was by becoming president himself and then controlling the federal machinery. In essence, Hoover controls the cleanup, the cover-up, from the get-go.
And they had to stop that, too.
Hoover's entire investigation is done in 5 days. And he wraps up a bow. Now, the Warren Commission is kind of forced to reach the same conclusions that the FBI has already reached in their published report.
And America was never the same, Roger, after that. We've never been the same, have we?
Well, it is a chain reaction of events. In other words, the Bay of Pigs begets the Kennedy assassination. The Kennedy assassination begets Watergate. These are all interrelated events of history. I mean, this is why four of the Watergate burglars are present at the Bay of Pigs, the same four who are in Dealey Plaza. How incredibly convenient.
These things just don't happen by chance, do they?
So there, I believe they're all at this juncture completely interconnected.
I think so.
But my book is also it's a portrait of Lyndon Johnson because he is nothing like the public image that he tries to portray. I mean, he is an abusive, amoral, crude, vicious, loudmouth bully. He is a popper of pills and a vicious drunk. He is a notorious womanizer. He's a physical coward. He's a sadist. This is a man who conducts White House staff meetings while sitting on the toilet.
What?
And he did that not just to be crude, but he enjoyed the discomfort that it caused all these young Ivy League Kennedy aides that he had inherited.
What, you mean they were surrounding him?
I mean, it's really extraordinary.
He was on the toilet and these people were around him?
Yes, he would conduct actual meetings while he was defecating.
You've got to be kidding me, Roger.
No, Lyndon Johnson was a very crude fellow, and he is a notorious womanizer. At one point, there's at least five women in the secretarial pool.
Of course, Kennedy was too, right?
No, I think it goes with the power profile. Look, Dwight Eisenhower was getting a little on the side.
I'm beginning to think that comes with the... Now, Reagan was pretty straight, though.
Well, yes and no. Reagan was married to Jane Wyman, and then after Jane Wyman divorced him, he went on a tear in which he bedded virtually every great-looking woman in Hollywood.
Well, but he wasn't the president then.
He was single.
Yeah.
That's the point. And then when he meets Nancy Davis and he gets married, I think he is forever a faithful husband. But this guy tore it up in his wild days. I mean, Marilyn Monroe, Lana Turner, Betty Grable, you name it. And
well, he had good. He had
the,
good
the
choice.
Gipper got there.
All right, let's take some calls for the rest of the hour that we've got you here. Let's go to John in Sheridan, Wyoming, to get things started. John, go ahead.
Thank you, George. Another great show.
Thank you.
If you will permit me, let me give three quick things that will help Mr. Stone.
All right.
When Bill Clinton in 1994 was president, he allowed Westinghouse to sell two nuclear reactors to North Korea, from which they've been extracting plutonium and from which they've been making nuclear weapons. The second item, in a CBS 60 Minutes interview just a few years ago, they were interviewing both Bill and Hillary, and for whatever reason, instead of on a soft sofa, they had him sitting on these high wooden bar stools. And in the middle of the interview, a studio light exploded behind Bill and Hillary. They both immediately leapt up to their feet. Now, remember, Hillary claims that she's battle-tested. Well, when Hillary leapt to her feet, she screamed at the top of her voice, "Jesus, Joseph, and Mary," and then while Bill was standing, she jumped into his lap, and she was whining and shivering and crying and woo-hoo-hoo, woo-hoo-hoo, like that, like a scared child walking through the cemetery at midnight. And the third item is when Hillary was working as an attorney, they showed this, it's an audio tape, they played it on Fox News late last year. She knowingly acquitted a man who had raped a woman. On a legal technicality, she got him acquitted. Then she called her friend, and she was laughing about it and cackling about it, that she had gotten her rapist client off the hook on a legal technicality. Geez. And so much for the myth of Hillary being the women's candidate.
Wow. Roger, you want to react to any of that?
Well, that last incident is very well covered in my book. He's absolutely right. Your caller is absolutely right. She laughs about the fact that that her client passed a lie detector test, which she says made her forever doubt lie detector tests. So she knows he's guilty. Hillary Clinton is nothing like her public image. She is a mean-spirited, angry, vicious, loud-mouthed, foul-mouthed, short-tempered, very greedy, very dominant, very abrasive and abusive. She has a mouth on her like a sailor. This is something else that I have some of her greatest sayings in my book. Most of them entail the F word.
And she could end up being our president.
If people knew the real Hillary and her epic greed, I mean, look, the Clinton Foundation is not a charity. It's a slush fund for grifters. It's a vehicle for the facilitation of multi-million dollar bribes. If you wanted a change in foreign policy, if you wanted to get rid of Gaddafi, or if you wanted the approval of an arms deal, or if you wanted a major defense contract, no matter what you wanted, you could buy it from Bill and Hillary. You had to grease the Clinton Foundation. You had to grease the Clintons personally in the form of these speech honorariums. I mean, Goldman Sachs, a bailed out bank, a bank that we bailed out with our tax dollars, is paying Hillary $675,000 for a 20-minute speech.
I wish I could make a speech that quickly. Wow.
Yeah, but this is our money. These guys crashed the economy with toxic mortgage-backed securities, and then they want to be bailed out. Creditors want to be bailed out.
Well, and we bail them out. Roger, we're going to come back, wrap things up, and take final phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM. With our special guest tonight, Roger Stone, we're going to come back and take final phone calls with Roger here on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, our final segment with Roger Stone. We'll get to your calls. Roger, what are you working on next? What's your next project?
I am working on a book with St. John Hunt, who also you know, was the co-author of my book on Jeb and the Bush crime family, which just came out very recently. It's interesting that 11 days after the book was published, Jeb must have read the book and he dropped out. I think because he understood that Donald Trump was probably going to raise the question of the 9/11 hijackers who were training in Florida. There were at least 21 individual complaints to the Florida State Police, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, about these strange men and their activities. But nobody followed up on that.
No.
It was kind of lost intelligence. It is a shame because my book on the Bush crime family has a chapter on the Reagan assassination attempt, which is, I think, unearthing a lot of information that is not commonly known. The many, many strange things about that attempt on Reagan, starting with the fact that in the Secret Service manual, the car is supposed to be as close to the hotel door as possible. Why is Reagan walking 50 yards down the street to get to his car?
That's right. And they could put that car.
He's supposed to be surrounded by a diamond of Secret Service agents. If you see the pictures, they're all behind him. The government has never released the final report, but both Leslie Stahl at CBS and Judy Woodruff at NBC report on the air a second gunman on a plateau, on like a patio, above the hotel door. If you get the actual non-cropped picture taken by Michael Evans, you can actually clearly see this man, although the copy of the picture that the government released had cropped him out of the sight. Now, This would be consistent with the medical report, which reports that Reagan was hit from an upward elevation, yet Hinckley is crouching and shooting from below. All five of Hinckley's bullets are identified. None of them hit Reagan. But when they dig what they think will be a bullet out of Reagan's chest, it's not a bullet at all. It is a small, round, metal disc like the size of a dime with razor edges on it, identified as a weapon in the 1978 Church Committee hearings, a weapon designed by the Central Intelligence Agency for assassination. The backstory here is very clear. Al Haig and George Bush are fighting over control of crisis management. Reagan can't decide who to give the ball to. George Bush realizes the enormously lucrative nature of Iran-Contra, which would fall under his purview as the head of crisis management. So I don't know whether this was an attempt to kill Reagan or to warn him, but shortly thereafter, he would give Vice President Bush control over many of the intelligence services in the clandestine war in South America.
Those boys play to keep, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, John Hinckley, the shooter, is a longtime Bush family associate. The Dallas newspapers immediately identify John Hinckley Sr. and his wife as major Reagan donors. They've never given a dime to Reagan. They have given substantial money to every one of George Bush's campaigns for the Senate in 64 and 70 and his House race in 66. Hinckley Sr. is likely himself in the service of the CIA. He was a Houston oil man doing offshore stuff at the same time George Bush was doing this through Zapata, which appears to have been a front for the agency as early as the early 1960s. So it is interesting that the Hinckley's other son is actually scheduled to dine with Neil Bush, the brother of George W. Bush, on the very day that Reagan is shot.
That is just too weird. These coincidences are too weird. I, of course, never believe in coincidences. Melissa in Troy, Ohio, first-time caller. Go ahead, Melissa.
Hi.
Hi there.
How are you?
Good.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Melissa.
You're sorry.
I'm going to have to let you go. Need a better connection. Try back. Ed in Philadelphia. Welcome to the program, Ed.
Hi, George. Hi, Mr. Stone. It's a privilege to speak to you both.
Hi.
I have a comment and then an important question. One is about prophecy and Donald Trump.
Okay.
I've been trying to contact the Trump campaign since last summer. I have an idea that could help him get elected by using an icon.
Let me guess. Nobody called you back. Go ahead.
Well, no. I have an idea for him that he could use an icon of America that's sadly dying in a shipyard in Philadelphia here where I live. The SS United States of America was built and went into service in 1952. It was the fastest ocean liner in American shipbuilding history. And all of our unsaved historical vessels have been sold for scrap over the years, unfortunately. By some miracle, the SS United States of America is still sitting in the Philadelphia shipyard for decades. It's all rusted. They've been trying to unload it for years. The people have been sending small contributions to keep it afloat. It's all neglected, and the logo is still on it, the SS United States of America. My idea is that Donald Trump could get millions of dollars in free good publicity if he'd offer to have people who want to send him like small donations, like a dollar to fund, for Trump to match their money to save it and do a potentially helpful and potential famous future campaign commercial that Donald Trump saved the United States of America. And I wanted to ask you, Mr. Stone, if you could give the idea to Mr. Trump via your channel. Now, quickly, this plays into my question. I wanted to ask you both, George and Mr. Stone, if either of you have ever heard of all the alleged prophecies of Donald Trump becoming president that are popping up all over the internet, including Bible codes, as well as one man, a retired firefighter, who has a prophecy up allegedly from 2011 in which he saw a vision from God while watching Trump give a speech on TV. If true, it could be a good example of God works in mysterious ways. And just, you know, the simple sentence in front of the video that he has up is, some pious people say casino owner Donald Trump is not a godly man. Should we, however, ask, is Donald Trump God's man? Retired firefighter Mark Taylor claims that the Lord has chosen Mr. Trump to pull America back from the cliff. Rick Wiles interviews Mark about his amazing 2011 prophecy that Donald Trump has been marked by God to lead America into freedom from corrupt government. I think we should have him on your show, George. What do you think?
Well, let's see if he gets a nomination first, and then possibility. And you're talking about the person with prophecy as well. We shall see. We shall see. I don't know if you dabble in that, Raj, do you?
Well, I probably don't, by and large. However, I have to admit that Trump has overcome enormous number of obstacles that would have destroyed a regular politician. I mean, when he correctly criticized John McCain, a man who's been on the Veterans Affairs Committee in this country for 30 years, by the way, 1,200-plus veterans died last year waiting for medical care. And who sponsored the legislation to essentially cover that up and hold nobody responsible? Why, that would be John McCain and Bernie Sanders. So everybody said, oh, when he attacked McCain, he's attacking a war hero. He's going to self-destruct. He didn't. When he said that the Mexicans were sending rapists and murderers and others conducting crime here, everyone said he would self-destruct. He hasn't. So it is amazing how well he has done. He has made history. No one has anyone ever spent so little and got so many votes. He's broken all the rules that I thought were still true. They're all out the window. So there is something interesting, some guidance here. And I do think he is a strong candidate for president against Hillary in the general election because he is fearless, because he is courageous, because he will give no quarter.
Would you accept some appointment if he called on you?
I really have no interest in working for government. I worked in the Office of Economic Opportunity under Don Rumsfeld by appointment of President Richard Nixon. But I have generally been a campaign aide. I was on the senior staff of 9 Republican presidential campaigns, starting with Nixon through Reagan. And then later, to my regret, for George Bush. This is really before I did my research that indicated what his role was in Dallas and the other things I learned about the Bushes. They're not conservatives. They're crony capitalists. They have dabbled in drug trafficking, not only George H.W. When he's in the Central Intelligence Agency, when he's vice president, but as I establish in the book, Jeb himself is dealing drugs in boarding school, in college, in Miami, in Houston. And that's fine, except for in the next breath, he's a drug warrior. He wants to bust people for possession of a small amount of drugs. He wants the penalties in the war on drugs increased. The war on drugs is an expensive, ignominious failure,
huge failure, should be legalized.
We're not rehabilitating anybody. We're incarcerating people for these long terms. The only people who this is good for are the people who run the prisons. And they're,
right,
generally speaking, big Hillary Clinton supporters.
And as they become more privatized, there's going to be more and more people put in there. Believe me.
So it is, just a failed notion on the whole drug front.
Janesville,
you know,
Wisconsin.
What's really interesting this year is the way that I find that many of the Bernie Sanders supporters and the Trump supporters are saying the same thing. They're tired of being screwed by Wall Street. They're tired of picking up the tab when these scoundrels bankrupt companies and make a fortune on failure. They're tired of foreign wars that don't seem to have any justification or reason. they're tired of these massive global trade deals. NAFTA has destroyed the American job market. Ross Perot was exactly right when he said that big sucking sound you hear are the jobs leaving America. And now they're trying to push TPP and TPA, which Ted Cruz is supporting. So Trump is the only nationalist in the field of globalists. He's the only candidate who believes in American sovereignty. What I like best about him, in all honesty, because I disagree with him on a number of things, is the fact that you can't buy him. He doesn't take special interest campaign contributions. No one owns Trump. Nobody can buy influence with Trump, and that's why the lobbyist class, hired by the donor class, are so apoplectic about his candidacy. He is completely unpredictable.
Is he going to get the support in the House and the Senate? Are the, you know, congressmen and senators, are they going to back him and give him the legislation he may ask for?
Well, if he goes right to the American people and convinces him that he's right, yes, because politicians really care about one thing, re-election. So if they see a parade, they will run out in front of that parade and act like they're leading it. You're not going to go get this in some grubby little deal. You're going to have to appeal to the American people who are really hungry for sweeping change.
Oh, yes.
And then if you're a congressman or a senator, you realize that you may get swept out of office if you stand in the way of real reform. That's how you get the votes.
All right, let's go next to Frank in Hollywood, Maryland. Hi, Frank. Go ahead.
George, glad to be back with you. Mr. Stone, now, I believe most of what you're saying about Lyndon Johnson, but if he said it was so evil, why would he bother with a civil rights movement? He did more for civil rights than any president before or since. And then
this is easily explained. Lyndon Johnson is an arch segregationist who leads the opposition to every civil rights bill during the time that he is in the Senate. And then when a bill finally passes in 1958, Lyndon Johnson, who's running for president and wants to be acceptable in the North, adds an amendment to the bill requiring anybody who violates the Civil Rights Act be tried in a state, not federal court. Well, that means in Mississippi, you're going to be tried in a court with an all-white jury. Lyndon Johnson realizes that Robert Kennedy is his only real danger for nomination, so he does a complete about-face and he embraces civil rights. After a lifelong relationship as a segregationist, he really does it to stop Robert Kennedy from having an issue to run against him for re-election in 1964. He himself personally used the N-word. He was extremely abusive towards black people. He would play for his Southern cronies, the Southern bloc, but at the same time, he did push through the first bill. Now, the controversy comes then over the Voting Rights Act, which comes 2 years later. The movie Selma, about Selma, Alabama, mm-hmm. is exactly right. Martin Luther King forced Johnson to pass that bill. Johnson had no interest in passing it. And he was essentially forced into it by the courageous action of Dr. King, who went to Selma and got beat up. And his people were beaten up. The public outcry was so great that Lyndon Johnson was forced to embrace a voting rights bill. Now, his lackeys have tried to rewrite this, like Joe Califano, but we know that Andrew Young writes in his book that Lyndon Johnson referred to Dr. Martin Luther King as that crazy N-word preacher. Who thinks he's running?
And why did Johnson decide not to seek re-election when he could have run for that extra term?
Because he knew he couldn't win. Once Eugene McCarthy nicked him in the New Hampshire primary, McCarthy, a very uninspiring candidate, but riding the wave of revulsion of the Vietnam War, Johnson knows that he can't win. Although he does have a secret plan to get back in the race. And arrive in Chicago on the top of one of the hotels in a helicopter. And throughout the entire 68 convention, John Connally, who's the head of the Texas Democrats, is telling Hubert Humphrey, if you move off the Vietnam War even an inch, if you do anything to undermine the president in Vietnam, I'm going to nominate Lyndon Johnson from the floor. So they have this constant pressure about Johnson jumping back in.
In the end, J. Edgar Hoover and Mayor Daley tell him the scene in Chicago is so chaotic with anti-war protesters that the president's safety could not be guaranteed. Therefore, he abandons his plan to vault into the 68 convention and make a comeback.
We go to another caller, Joe in the Bronx. Go ahead, Joe.
George, how are you?
Good.
Mr. Stone, I wanted to ask you a question about Kennedy's assassination. What happened to Kennedy's brain after he was assassinated?
Apparently it's gone.
It literally disappears.
Yeah.
It literally disappears. It is interesting that there are also, Arlen Specter is given no x-rays or photographs from the autopsy. He's denied them. And what they give him instead are artists' renderings of them.
Which, of course, you could make any way you want.
And Specter threatened to resign over this, and then ultimately backed down.
They classified information, yet we still haven't seen anything, Raj. How long is it going to be? It's been 53 years now.
As you know, the president has the authority to knock the disclosure back. It's interesting that at this point, little known fact, all of the Watergate documents, all of the Watergate tapes have been released, except those that deal specifically with Nixon discussing either the Kennedy assassination or the Bay of Pigs.
That's right.
Those are still redacted and confidential.
Yeah. I wonder what he knew. And you knew Nixon well.
Knew him very well.
Did he? Now I got to ask you one more quick one. One more quick question. We're almost out of time. 30 seconds. Did Jackie Gleason really take Richard Nixon to Homestead Air Force Base and show him an alien, an extraterrestrial?
It's entirely possible. That account comes from Jackie Gleason's wife, who has every evidence of being a credible person. She claims she was told this by Jackie Gleason himself. Here's the thing to remember about Nixon. He was not a big drinker. Two drinks and he was really drunk. Three drinks and he was jovial and drunk.
Maybe
he
made up a great story, but who knows? Raj, thanks. We're out of time. All of Roger's work linked up at his website at coasttocoastam.com. Up next, change your aura, change your life.